Welcome to a series of podcasts from the Vegan Information Project. In each podcast, we'll be exploring in greater depth many of the issues that arose during the workshops facilitated by Tina Cubley towards the end of the VIP mini course on social movements.
A central dilemma in Marcuse's theory, sharply formulated in One-Dimensional Man, that continued to haunt him. How can the administered individuals, who have made their mutilation into their own liberties and satisfactions, liberate themselves from themselves as well as from their masters? How is it even thinkable the vicious circle be broken? In order to break through this vicious circle, individuals must transform their present needs, sensibility, consciousness, values and behaviour, while developing a new radical subjectivity, so as to create the necessary conditions for social transformation. Radical subjectivity for Marcuse practices the great refusal valorized in both Eros and Civilization and One-Dimensional Man. In Eros and Civilization, the great refusal is the protest against unnecessary repression, the struggle for the ultimate form of freedom, to live without anxiety. In One-Dimensional Man, however, the great refusal is fundamentally political, a refusal of repression and injustice, a saying no, an elemental opposition to a system of repression, a non-compliance with the rules of a rigged game, a form of radical resistance and struggle. In both cases, the great refusal is based on a subjectivity that is not able to tolerate injustice, and that engages in resistance and opposition to all forms of domination, instinctual and political.
Right, so here we are again. This is Tina Cubley and Roger Yates. We're doing
and Zami.
Doing the second VIP podcast. This is the third altogether, in the sense that there was two for the first theme. So we're calling this Matters Arising, and this comes from a talk and then subsequent workshops that Tina facilitated on Herbert Marcuse's concept of the Great Refusal, and we've just heard you read out a pretty good exposition of the meaning of that from One-Dimensional Man and Eros and Civilization. For you then, Tina, this really, to kind of boil it down, is kind of saying, you know, how can people who have been bought off, first of all, realize that they've been bought off, and then secondly, do something about it? And also, your answer ultimately is that veganism is a great refusal. That's right, isn't it?
Yes, that's absolutely true. I remember when I was giving a talk on this subject, which preceded our workshops and practical exercises on Marcuse's theory, I began my speech by saying that you had asked me if I was assuming that my audience were going to be anarchists or already anti-capitalist, and already have an understanding of capitalism as violence. And I thought about that and said that as vegans, they are already resistant to authority. I mean, veganism is already, it's already what Marcuse calls negative thinking, which is essentially critical thinking in action. So being vegan is already a profound act of resistance. So that is a way to embody the Great Refusal. I would see the Great Refusal ultimately as being a theory which is answered, you know, made real, made practical in the world by living as a vegan.
Exploring some of the themes then that cropped up during the workshops then, you talked about embodying the Great Refusal, and some of the people brought up the difficulty of doing that, which leads you into one of the themes that you wanted to talk about, which is the liberated imagination, right?
Yes, absolutely. Before I kind of expand on the Marcuse's and my own definitions of the liberated imagination, a thing that often comes up, a form of opposition to this idea which often comes up, is that it's all very well for a few privileged lifestyle anarchists to kind of enact the Great Refusal, but for most people this is beyond the possibilities of their everyday life. And my answer to that is that, yes, there is no immediate solution. Marcuse never presents an immediate solution. What he does is present an immediate imperative that we have to begin thinking critically about the situation we're in. We have to begin connecting with each other in a critical way. We have to begin resistance. That doesn't mean to say that we can instantly opt out of capitalist system. For example, one thing that came up, I mean, I was explaining how I try to avoid consumption in a variety of strategies, including dumpster diving, shoplifting, etc. And a lot of people very justifiably point out they're simply not in a position to do those things for various practical reasons, you know, it just is not a possibility for them. And they then say, well, you know, the Great Refusal then is not possible for me. My response to that is that what we need to answer this, to combat this form of oppression, is for people to connect with one another, to form community resistance. And the more we connect with one another in solidarity and real communication, which is the ultimate resistance to capitalist tyranny, the more possibilities will open before us. And this leads me to explain the concept of the liberated imagination, which, as Marcuse saw it, goes hand in hand with the Great Refusal. You know, they enable each other. You cannot have revolution while our imaginations are still caged by false needs. We cannot get revolution while we are still mentally enslaved. And yet, how can we liberate our imaginations in a society built on oppression and exploitation? How can a free mind be possible in that world? I mean, this is where, actually, in the handout I made, I say that the liberated imagination is both a necessary precondition for and a result of revolutionary struggle. We need to conceive of forms of existence and possibilities for action beyond the world we have made for ourselves, beyond this repressive reality. And in practical terms, that's what I said to people. I said, today there may not be another option for you. Tomorrow, if you connect with one another, there might be, you know? So it's about community building. We can't have revolution alone. And that's something Marcuse realised and constantly referred to, I think.
Yeah,
solidarity,
this,
you know?
Yeah, this kind of crops up a lot in kind of progressive thought, isn't it? The relationship between theory and practice, essentially.
Yeah, absolutely, because, I mean, to a certain extent, that's why a focus on theory is perceived as being the expression of privilege, you know? Because, like, often when I advocate certain strategies of resistance which are illegal in a petty kind of way, most people say, oh, it's okay for you because you're a middle-class ex-college kid and you are okay to do all this stuff, you know? You don't have a family, you don't have various forms of social pressure, etc. So you're this kind of lifestyle anarchist. Which, apart from being kind of insulting, is, you know, is quite an interesting take on it, because it's like, it's interesting and depressing that resistance is seen as being the expression of a form of privilege, and the reason that is the case is because we don't connect enough with one another. Resistance would become a real everyday possibility for everybody if we began to create a culture where we care about and support one another, rather than just going off and saying, okay, I'm opting out of the system because that's my, it's within my abilities to do so. You can just, you know, shift for yourself, you know? That's not what the Great Refusal is about. And to come to the theory and practice divide, one of the most powerful things I've ever read on this subject, which I connected with so much, was Marcuse saying about the student movement. And he said how the radical utopian demands of the student movement far surpassed anything he ever wrote or thought of. And yet, the difference is, they were formulated in action. You know, these are activists out on the street, smashing things, changing things, you know? And their theory, he claims, goes far beyond his own. You know, like, the utopian demands of their movement, where do they come from? Practice. They come from people out on the streets, connected with one another, rebelling against oppression. And this is why, another thing I actually said in my talk on this subject was that people forget that One Dimensional Man was actually used as a direct action handbook, in that sense, by the student movement, you know?
And Marcuse was a spark.
Yes. Exactly.
Yeah.
And that his name was on graffiti, like sprayed on buildings and everything.
It's hard to imagine an academic's name being done like that now, isn't it?
I know, but that's rather tragic, I think. I think that is so cool, you know. Mm. And I just think, yeah, that's really inspiring for me, because so often, you know, whenever you talk about theory and whenever you kind of try to explore the ideas on which your movement is founded, you get a lot of opposition to that. And you get people saying, oh, you just talk, you don't do. And you feel like saying, is it not possible? Talking is connection and exploration, and it's an essential part of revolution. How can Marcuse's ideal of negative, that is, critical thinking, exist in a movement where we have ceased to be critical about ourselves, you know? It's just like, I constantly need to be critical about myself because I don't have a fully liberated imagination. I struggle to have a liberated imagination. I'm as enslaved and as shaped by the system I come from as anyone else. Like, I struggle with socially constructed ideas and ways of perceiving things all the time. I catch myself being part of forms of privilege and, like, being part of oppressing people. And I have to constantly critique myself about that. And it just makes me sad, I think, that there is so much opposition to theory. There is this perception that theory and practice are antithetical concepts. My view, and I think I'm pretty confident in saying Marcuse's view too, is that either one will die without the other. We cannot have a movement which has no theory. Equally, we cannot have a movement that has no practice.
And ideally, they're supposed to feed off each other, right?
Yes, well, that's a core belief of the anarchist movement, that both are each other, you know? It's just, they are part of the same dynamic whole. You cannot separate them.
Mm-hmm. Let's try to come back to a major theme in another way, which is the fact that the Great Refusal is essentially a kind of a form of opting out, you know, on all kinds of levels, you know, consciousness, but actually in practice and everything else. And so I just wanted to tease out the thing about there's a potential eliteness to the idea, because first of all, it's kind of suggesting that people who have been bought off, who are opting in, as it were, they don't realise that, essentially. So in an Irish phrase, you've got to cop on, you've got to kind of realise. What Marcuse talks about is false needs, and so you've got to suddenly realise, well, hang on a minute, all the things that I thought were essential for my life are actually pretty false. They're not really a part of liberation. I wonder whether you can say a bit more about that. Sorry about the long-winded question.
No, that's cool. I kind of think there's several questions in there. So you're kind of talking about the potential tyranny and smugness of telling people their needs are false.
Yeah, it's a little bit like the Marxist saying that you're suffering from false consciousness kind of idea.
Yeah, nobody wants to be told that. No, but I think what essentially prevents that from being a elitist statement is the fact that is the humility of the speaker. You know, humility is necessary, it's essential, you know. Well, apart from the fact that it's an essential revolutionary quality, I cannot go up to somebody and say, you need to start developing radical consciousness, without saying the same about myself. But if, however, I recognise that my beliefs, my insecurities, the way I live my life are all still on that journey towards my own radical consciousness, that my own radical consciousness is a constantly developing, vulnerable thing that, you know, I need to be constantly critical of myself, then I feel not a sense of entitlement, but a need and a right to explain my journey to others and connect with them on theirs. And I don't see that as being an elitist, dictatorial, talking down to you kind of thing. I see it as being a solidarity thing. You don't need to lecture people to connect with them, because I think we all feel the oppression that's all around us, however aware or not of it we are, you know? And I just think that to speak to people about those things is powerful and necessary. And essentially, it would only be an elitist, unacceptable way of speaking to people if you exempted yourself from your demands for a new radical consciousness. You know, to exempt yourself would be unforgivable. But that's what Marcuse does not do, and what no one inspired by the Great Refusal should do. Critique yourself first, then you start on everyone else.
Okay. Coming back to false needs, which is obviously tied to consumer culture and everything nowadays, in the workshop you did something very practical. You asked everybody to write down what they bought.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, so can you kind of remember the outcome of that and, you know, why it was important?
Yeah, well, what I was trying to get at with that exercise was just to examine how we participate in consumer culture and the possibilities that were there for us today and we didn't notice them, we didn't have the energy to pursue them, we were opposed in pursuing them somehow. You know, and it's just, basically it was kind of a liberated imagination awakening exercise, if you like, you know, because I just wanted everyone to think, before I purchase, before I become a cog in the machinery, before I hand over money for something, is there another way, you know? Mm. And just, what is it possible to live without? What do I really need, you know? That's what Marcuse is trying to get at. And of course, it's incredibly difficult to get at for everybody, because what we're doing, we're trying to uncover, we're digging through layers and layers of capitalist and consumer cultural conditioning. You know, it's just, we cannot conceive of a world where we're not surrounded by material stuff, you know?
The story of stuff.
Yeah, exactly. It's just, we cannot really conceive of that. And I'm not making the elitist claim that I can. I try to. It's part of my struggle. But I'm still, of course, on that journey myself, you know, so.
You know, one major way that we can do this, though, isn't it, is to differentiate between needs and wants, which is one of the great things that capitalism kind of chimed in with, really, in the sense that they started to make people's wants into needs. And so,
yeah, exactly. Know. Wants are converted into needs. And there's all sorts of stuff going on there. Capitalism has an answer for everything in that respect, like peer pressure for teenagers, as an example of
the must-have gadget.
Yeah,
and
exactly.
the must-see film, and the must-have this. And,
yes, and I'm sure that those wants for pieces of capitalist, environmentally destructive plastic rubbish, in most cases, are genuinely perceived and experienced as needs, you know? And that's how insidious and dangerous the capitalist mentality is, you know?
Yeah, well, one practical thing probably listeners could do, really, is look around the house and see what's been discarded and what was, presumably, a few months ago or a year ago or something, an essential I must have at the time. And
yes.
And now it's a, well, you know, who cares?
Yeah, that would be really fascinating. Everybody listening to this, whatever you think of everything I've just said, it would be interesting. Please take a few minutes to do that. Just look around your house. What do you have that you want as opposed to need? You know, think about false needs with regard to your own life. I mean, I'm doing it as we speak, so yeah, do it yourself. It's fascinating.
So did Marcuse need all those hippopotamuses in
My two hippopotamuses come from thrift stores, so don't tell me about that. Please.
I wonder if anybody ever pointed out to Marcuse that his hippopotamuses were a false need.
He would probably be the first to agree with that.
Okay, a couple of more themes then to conclude with this. Going back to a kind of practical question in a way. About social movements, in the sense that one of the themes that came up in the workshop led you to kind of talk about a difference between what you might call a kind of counter consciousness and, you know, a kind of subcultural self-satisfaction that might go on. So, in other words, even social movements can be kind of bought off a little bit. That's what you're getting at, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad you asked me that, because it's one of the themes that I felt most passionately about in that second part of the workshop, which is... Sorry, I'm being kicked by Zami here. Which is that there is a profound difference between a radical counter consciousness, which is an actual threat to the system, and a subcultural self-satisfaction, as I put it, which becomes parasitic to the system, and in fact depends on the continued existence of the system as something to define itself against. In other words, it is quite happy to coexist with the system, even if it doesn't admit to that, you know? It's just like, it becomes a subset of society, not a threat, not a disruptive force, not a kind of centre of revolutionary action. It doesn't make anything new. It coexists. It is static. You know, it is fundamentally static, and that's the difference. I'm well aware that that's not at all popular.
Well, I mean, in some senses, though, it does align with some social movement theory, which talks about that, how, you know, once radical groups moderate, and then they start to, you know, be co-opted by the system, and also, in the end, Orwellian again, you can't tell them apart, really, in a way, in the end.
Yes, absolutely. That's, I mean, thinking Animal Farm here, but that's exactly what I'm talking about. And it's kind of like, it ends up being so closely, you know, the professed aims of our subculture become so closely bound up with identity and kind of group identity that it ceases to be revolutionary, and that it becomes a static thing, in that it requires the system in order to fight itself against the system. A counterculture, as the product of counterconsciousness, is not like that, because it is dynamic, it is changing, and it is a force for change. You know, it is not satisfied, it does not stay still. It does not endlessly dwell on its own definitions of itself. I kind of see subcultures as looking inward at themselves. They are their own spectators, as it were. It's kind of an image thing.
Yeah.
Whereas subcultures look outwards constantly, and they constantly push the boundaries outwards as well. Countercultures want a whole world of counterculture. They want a world where resistance has ceased to mean anything, because there is nothing left to resist, and the world is the world that we all need and want, you know?
Mm.
It's just, countercultures do not want to keep existing. Subcultures do, you know? Subcultures are quite happy to stay there. Countercultures don't want to exist as they are. They want to change the world, you know? That's the difference.
Yeah, always pushing the barriers. I mean, one way that you can look at how movements moderate and kind of get bought off is exactly when they actually forget that they're supposed to be revolutionary in the first place.
Yeah, I think you see it in all movements, really, at least to a greater or lesser extent. It's always a lurking tendency, I think, because
But it's very worrying, though, isn't it? Because it's very destructive for the original aims and aspirations. You know, the core values can become threatened. You know, if people forget that they're revolutionary and the idea is to bring about radical change, and suddenly it becomes something else, then that means that the vision gets limited, it gets reduced, you know, it gets shrunk down, you know, and you just end up with a pale version of what you're supposed to have in the first place.
Absolutely. I think that's a very profound point you made, and particularly with reference to you saying that the core values become threatened. Not only that, the movement becomes so counter-revolutionary that the core values are perceived to be threatening.
Yeah.
So when, I don't know, when you challenge a movement, the way a movement is going, based on your perception of the movement's core values, it's like the core values were never there, you know? It's just like they've been lost, submerged, confused utterly, you know? It's just
And a lot of new members go, well, I don't care about the core values because I'm just going to define everything for myself.
Yeah, and the thing is, I don't know, you cannot do that, because even, for example, take the anarchist movement, which, of course, among all social movements, is distinguished by its dynamic, continually changing, essentially practical nature, you know? And yet, there is a humble acknowledgement, there is a constant need to learn from comrades' experience, to share, to self-criticise, you know? And these are values which have been discarded, you know? And that's just, I don't know, it's that kind of attitude that's, that you can, I don't know how to express this, but that you can simply redefine everything for yourself without reference to the movement around you, to the values on which the movement grew and was built, without reference to the realities that confront you and the realities to which for which you are supposed to be fighting.
Mm.
It's just, it kills revolution, you know? Unquestioning acceptance of subcultural mores and ways of doing things, that is something we see in the mainstream, you know? I just do this because it's what people do. That's what the mainstream does. It's when we start doing it, you know, the revolution's dead.
Yeah, well, you know, when people start defining their movement which, in such a way that it really just defines or describes themselves, then, you know you're onto a problem there.
Yeah, that's absolutely it, because I think we continually need to conceive of, what Marcuse referred to as surrealist forms of protest, but in the context that he was referring to, we need to constantly challenge ourselves to think beyond our own experiences, our own perceptions, our own comfort zones, if you like, you know? And we need to constantly redefine revolutionary struggle in new ways. We need to break down all the boundaries, all the ways we think, oh, this is what we do.
Hmm.
We need to think, what could we do? And it's then that possibilities start opening up, you know? We need to stop thinking this is all we can do, because that is bowing down to the mainstream's socially constructed reality, you know?
Yeah.
We need to make our own reality, and we urgently need to do that.
Indeed we do, and yes, it is urgent as well. Now, just in terms of completeness, I just want to just talk about a last issue. I hope in a way that, if nothing else, this podcast makes people want to kind of go out and check out the work of Marcuse. They could start off with Herbert's Hippopotamus on YouTube, which is that's where the hippo references come from. And there is a part in that where the interviewer is kind of goading Marcuse to say that he supports violence. And he doesn't get him to do it. But it's really, the reason that he's trying to in the first place is probably because he doesn't understand something important within Marcuse, which is the idea of defensive violence. Do you want to just say a few words about that just for us to end with?
Yeah, sure. Again, that's another aspect of Marcuse's theory and thought that I feel really passionately about. And one very moving thing which made me think a lot about that was an interview with Angela Davis when she was in jail, and she was being asked the same question over and over, do you support violence? And she said some very moving things about her upbringing and all the violence around her, you know, racial segregation and everything. She finished by saying, you know, so when you ask me if I support violence, it just makes me think that you know nothing about the realities for black people, you know? And I think that's such a moving and profound and revolutionary, subversive statement, you know? And it just makes me think that how dare a society built completely on violence, defined by violence, saturated by violence, how dare it point the finger at us and say violence, you know? It makes a complete nonsense of the word, which again, very Orwellian concept, the way words are made to mean something completely opposite to what they mean. It's like freedom, for example. We have freedom, you know? It's just, as Marcuse points out, our freedom is unfreedom. And we, the voice for non-violence, the warriors for a non-violent world, are violent. It's just turns everything upside down to define things as it wants. The idea of defensive violence, essentially, it's that the world is already so violent, we are threatened in so many ways, that our revolutionary struggle, when we fight back, that is a form of violence that is not only excusable, but entirely justifiable, necessary, essential. It's an act of solidarity. We're abandoning people if we don't react to violence with defensive violence, if you understand what I mean.
Yeah, it's a form of self-defense, isn't it?
Absolutely, yes. I mean, I love it when Marcuse finishes an essay on kind of ecofeminism and, you know, when in his search for revolutionaries, when he says the end of violence is still to be fought for. And I think that's his definition of defensive violence, essentially. we need to fight for the end of violence.
Yeah, actually, I remember I put that on a Facebook, what's it called, status, at one time, and somebody misinterpreted it as me saying everybody should be violent.
Yeah.
And again, you know, it just goes the way that, you know, use that one word and then you're in trouble kind of thing.
Yeah, exactly. And I just think, again, another exercise for all listeners who probably absolutely hate me by now, but never mind. you know, look around you. Next time, before you decry violent tactics on behalf of, you know, on the part of any social justice movement, look around you. I don't know, kind of see the world through the eyes of somebody oppressed in ways you are not. I guarantee you will see violence everywhere. Patriarchal violence, speciesist violence, racist violence, ableist violence. It is everywhere. We have a culture formed out of violence. So just think about that next time you are about to open your mouth and accuse an activist of supporting violence.
Okay, well, on that potentially controversial note, we shall bring this to a close. And what's our next theme, just so we know?
It is independent media we're doing right. Next.
Okay.
So... tune in and hate us even more next time.
Okay.